Okay, turn to your review, and real quick, we're just going to take two or three questions to get us started. Christ is the mediator of what?
The new covenant.
Mediator of the covenant. Covenant is based on what? Better what?
Promises.
Promises. Okay. Now, I asked question 42, and let me just elaborate a little bit. I said, what's the difference? What is different between the two? First of all, between the two covenants. Secondly, there are a lot of things different between the two covenants. What I'm really interested in, what is different between the two in terms of those to whom it applies?
You cannot make them perfect. The first one could not make perfect, but the second one can. Makes perfect. Or forgives sins.
Okay, that's true. To whom do they apply? This is a simple question. To whom do they apply?
Jew
and then what?
And then to all spiritual people.
Okay. Think back in the chapters we just studied that the question is based around. Chapter 8.
Christ's death forgave sins even under the old law and then forward all of it.
Yeah, I got you all confused somewhere. No, it's a simple question. Jeremiah 31. He talks about a covenant, an old covenant. What was required to be in a covenant relationship under the old law?
Circumcision.
You were born into it.
Thank you. Finally. None of the answers are wrong. It was you were born into it. What about the second one?
You were born into it.
How do you...
You learn of it. And then you...
You enter it by what?
Choice.
Choice? Faith. How do you enter it? Faith. You're in the old covenant. If you were under the old covenant, the only way you could be in the old covenant... There were opportunities, and I've just lost my words,
apostasize?
No, when you teach somebody. Proselyte. There were proselyte Jews, but the old covenant was by lineage, by the fact that you were born into it. Of course, as Jeremiah points out, you learned the law. The law was taught to you. After you were in the covenant relationship, the new covenant is one of you enter by faith, and you learn about that law before you enter, not after. It's quite what is practiced sometimes in the world. Okay, so we had introduced. Well, actually, the covenant goes all the way back to chapter 7, verse 22, where he first started talking about it, and. We'll continue talking about it as we're in this section for chapter 8, the Jeremiah's prophecy about the God's plan all along was to bring in this second covenant, because the first one could not accomplish forgiveness of sins. Okay, so let's pick up in Hebrews 9, verse 1. Now, even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship in the earthly sanctuary. There was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread. This is called the holy place. Behind the second veil, there was the tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense, and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod was budded, and the tables of the covenant. And above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. But these things we cannot now speak in detail. So he starts off in this section by rehearsing what existed in terms of this, as he says in verse 1, the regulations of divine worship, we'll deal with that, and the earthly sanctuary. He makes this statement in verse 5. He says, these things we cannot speak of in detail. What's he mean? Maybe why is? Why is that a fact? Speak up.
The tabernacle
doesn't exist, does it? The ark doesn't exist. None of these things exist. Now, there's a form of worship taking place, Advent, in the temple in Jerusalem. But these things are gone. They are no more. And the thing I want to draw your attention to, and I thank you for what he's doing, it's not so much focusing on the details, because he doesn't, the details are available only by revelation. What he's trying to focus on, will focus on, is the service, which is, as we'll see in the rest of chapter 9, and the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctuary, the inner part of the tabernacle behind the veil, in terms of the priesthood and the sacrifice both. And so the emphasis here is not on the details that he describes, but rather on what he's trying to get through to the people he's writing to, again, about the nature of the high priest they have, the service they have, promises they have, the covenant they have, and how that's superior to what was under the old law. And more importantly, superior to what they're being challenged by, no doubt, in their time frame. Just out of curiosity, did anybody notice, when we said all that, did anybody notice any problems with the first, with this description? Yeah, Rod, what?
The altar.
Okay.
Is in the wrong place.
Yeah, the altar's in the wrong place. The best explanation I have for that, if you look in, you don't have to go there if you take my word for it, in 2 Chronicles 16:26-19, this word is translated altar here. If you go back in the Greek, in Septuagint, you'll find that it's translated as censer. Same thing's true in Ezekiel 8:11. In the King James, New King James in particular, it's also done that way. The word here can be censor, it can be altar. And the most likely thing that is in reference to is the censor, because what would happen when did the censor incense ever go into the Holy of Holies?
On the Day of Atonement.
So it was associated with the service inside of the veil. And if you look in the New American Standard in the footnote here, you'll find altar. You'll find it put a footnote in for censer. And so I think that's really what probably is in view. But like I say, I don't think his emphasis is on the details around the tabernacle. That's really not where it's going. There's a whole lot more to be said about the tabernacle than he had to say. But rather to try to start to make this contrast of the service that would take place under that system and within that set of physical requirements. Okay? Any questions about that before I move on? Okay, 9:6. Now, when these things have been so prepared, I do want to make one other comment. Just a notice in passing. Verse 1 says, now even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship. What's the implication of that statement about the second covenant?
The same thing.
I'm sure everybody said the right thing. I just all said it at the same time. It also has regulations. That's not the point he's trying to. It is a point he's going to deal with, but even for us, there are also regulations. Okay? So let's move on. Start reading verse 6.
Ask a quick question.
Yeah.
And is there any significance in verse 2 and verse 3 where the holy place in verse 2 is not capitalized, but in verse 3, the Holy of Holies is?
Only in the translator's means of describing it. I had to go back. I think Holy of Holies, where it is used, typically ends up being capitalized where I see it. But that's not, remember, in the Greek, everything was capital. So it's not a matter of, this is the translators to do this to help, really just to help us understand as much as anything.
And it's where it's
associated like, it's associated just like just like they capitalize He, right? It's obvious it pertained to God. Inside the Holy of Holies is the seat of God, or the mercy seat. And so that's the other why they'd be driven that way. Okay. Try that again.
Sorry.
No problem. Ask me questions. Now, when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. But in the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. The Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of reformation. Okay. Out of the text, what part of the tabernacle is the priest in a regular? The outer part, right? They go in, they go into the outer part. You did some of your reference reading. They went in every day and trimmed the lamps inside of the outer tabernacle, and offered incense as well, put incense on the altar of incense. And you'll find both of those are back in Exodus. Like I said, check the reading. And then it says the priest entered. Who entered? I already answered the question. The high priest enters the second part. How often?
Once a year.
Once a year. When? What's the event?
Day of Atonement.
Day of Atonement, only time. And interesting, go back and look in Leviticus. It appears he actually went in and out of the Holy of Holies area twice. He went in the first time, let me rephrase that. When he went in the first time, he carried with him incense and a censer of incense. So he put incense on the fire plant pan and the coals to cover the area with incense. And then at that same time, he took blood for atonement for his own sins. And then he come back out, he appears in the reading of Leviticus, and prepare the goat. Two goats, right? One would go in, would be killed, the other would be let go. And so that's that. Well, a goat, and he'd go in and he would put it on use it for the sins of the people. So he had two events, two sacrifices, two different animals in the course of this. Verse 7, the author's really, and I think these are more probably key in terms of the argument he's going to make. All of them are in verse 7, at least the vast majority of them are. Except for this annual occasion, nobody entered the Holy of Holies, did they? And only the priest, the high priest, could enter at all, and he could only enter this once per year. And he could only go in if he carried a sacrifice for himself. That's the only way he was to go into the Holy of Holies. And then the other thing is the blood, the sacrifice he took in for the people, and for himself for that matter, was not a finality, had no finality about it. What happened 12 months later?
Do it again.
And 12 months after that, go do it again. And so it was inadequate to bring about a final resolution. There's another thing that's not in the Hebrew text here, but you'll find over in Leviticus, when the high priest was doing these events, nobody else, no other priest, no one was allowed into the area of the tabernacle. It was off limits that day while these activities were in place. So it was a very unique event that took place under the old law. What was the significance? I asked the question, significance of the limitation of entry once per year. The question might throw you off. Hopefully the verse won't. What's the writer say is the reason for this taking place in this environment the way it did?
I put down that Christ entered into the greater tabernacle just once, and so it was, you know, it was a copy of the true. And so as Christ was going to do this once for all time, I don't know if I got it from that verse.
Right.
But that it was significant.
He's trying to get some say what it says.
So I didn't
know
that.
Okay, what's it say? It says it's not been disclosed. What's not been disclosed? The way to the holy place. But wait a minute. I thought he just went into the holy place.
What's that got to do? I'm asking a question. What's that got to do with the limitation of it?
I said you may not appreciate the way I asked this question.
That's why I put verses 9 through 11.
Yeah.
That it explains it.
There was a whole set of a series of events here. But yes, you're right. It's a lousy question, like I said. Hold you back on verse 8.
Verse 9 says it's a symbol for the present time, yeah, which is an indication of what it's talking about.
Yes. As long as this tabernacle is standing, he uses the term it has that the way into the holy place has not been disclosed. What holy place?
The emergency of God.
Huh?
The emergency of God.
What do you mean? I mean, he's going in there. Of course it's disclosed. If it's the mercy seat of God, if it's the holy place in the tabernacle, what he's looking to is, as long as the tabernacle stood, there was no entrance into the holy place he's going to talk about. The sanctuary, even the more perfect sanctuary he's going to talk about as it goes on. Heaven. This is looking forward to Jesus. As long as this tabernacle was and these events were underway, the way into the holy place had not yet been revealed. And that holy place is just different. That's all I want to point out to you. That holy place is different in that verse than going inside of the veil. Okay? Everybody follow that?
It might be easier for us to follow if the translators have included the first part of verse 9 and verse 8. We seem to, you know, a lot of times we think that the thought changes from verse to verse. And
it really doesn't. A lot of times it doesn't change from chapter to chapter, for that matter. Okay? So, what is all this that's going on? That's going to be a bad question. I think Linda may have even answered it a while ago. What is it about these events, about this facility, about the activity that the priests are undertaking? I can't ask that question without answering it.
It's a shadow.
It is a shadow, it's a type, but the reverse is true, isn't it, in this sense? What is it a copy of?
Christ entering to the greater tabernacle.
Right. It's a copy of the things in heaven. And So this is, as he says in verse 9, is symbolic of what is to take place. It's a symbol to them. It's really a symbol. The present time here is not, remember we talked about historical present? Present time here is not while he's writing, it's not at the time he's writing this letter, because these things don't exist. It's in looking forward to the time that Christ would come and would carry out the sacrifice he would take into the more perfect tabernacle that is heaven. Okay? Hopefully I get too confused on that. But it's you just got to watch in that verse, because the holy place ends up changing on you. And they don't think, maybe if they'd have made it capital, it would help. Okay, and then in the last half of verse 9, of course, talking about the nature of the sacrifice. Okay? Because the sacrifice that the sacrifice is gone in this old covenant, of course, couldn't bring about the sins. And even the priest had to, the high priest, when he'd go in, he had to go in every year and make sacrifices for himself as well. And so, as the writer tells us,
Cross went in on the shedding of his blood.
Yeah, he went into the more perfect tabernacle, didn't he? High in heaven. Okay. The perfect in conscience here, just draw your attention to it, and I think this group knows, says it cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, whose conscience is, it's looking to the, cannot provide the forgiveness of sins, forgiveness from guilt. Conscience either accuses us or excuses us, over in Romans 2. And, you look over in chapter 10, verse 2, I guess, is probably verse 1 and 2, last half of verse 1. The same sacrifice was they offered continually year by year, which make perfect, it couldn't make perfect those who draw near, otherwise they would not have ceased to be offered. Would they not have ceased to be offered? Because the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had consciousness of sin. Same thought there. That blood would not forgive sins like the blood of Christ would as he develops. Okay? Any comments, questions about that? Okay. 9:11. And lesson 17.
Just a quick comment.
Yeah.
Back when we were talking about the verse 4 and the altar, if the altar censor, and yeah, maybe belaboring a point that isn't of any value, but if that's the censor, then it sounds like they left something out of the holy place.
Well, yeah.
Because there was an altar in the holy
place. There was an altar. So, and I think that's, I'm not sure why the translators of the New American Standard decided to put this versus censor, for example. Except that they were probably confused by that too. Yeah. But either way, something's not. It's not an attempt to describe in great detail what this tabernacle is all about. I think first bear in mind. Okay, verse 11. But when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation, and not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkling those who have been defiled sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Of course, it starts out. Always look for these. What somebody has described as stop words. They just describe some of the things going on under the old law and the sacrifices, and then it starts off in verse 11 with "but" in Christ. So here's the contrast coming, and. In the case of, as we talked a moment ago, this tabernacle, the service that he'd been talking about, just a shadow, of what was to come with Christ. And Christ would enter, of course, the perfect tabernacle, that is heaven. What kind of, these are all straight out of the text and going anyway. What type of blood is in view in this section, and in fact, probably without exception, although I can't have the right look, what kind of blood is in view every time, let's say for the time being, in Hebrews? No, not Christ's blood.
The blood of bulls and goats.
It's not always the blood of bulls and goats.
Sacrificial blood.
Always sacrificial blood that they talk about. And
Christ's blood runs sacrificial?
Yes. Yes. I'm just saying it's not limited to that. Goats, I mean, bulls and other sacrifices were also sacrificial. Remember, they used blood. That's what it's put for. Put for death. In this case, sacrificial death. And as Jim says, Christ's blood, what blood did he offer? Christ offered his own blood. His own death. I mean, it wasn't his literal blood, it was his death. How often did he need to do it?
Once.
Once for all time. That's what the word means. Once for all time. And then what was the output of it? What was the result of it?
Eternal redemption.
Okay? Eternal redemption. And then it goes on in verse 13 and 14, and having said what he just said, he has another one of these four words, introduction words, reason word, if you like, for if the blood of goats and bulls, etc., etc. There are two different kinds. Here he's talking about two different types of sacrifices, right? The first one, goats, blood of goats and bulls. We just talked about the Day of Atonement, where both of those were involved. Sacrifices were involved, as we know, all throughout the year with the Jews. There's continual sacrifices, various kinds of sacrifices. And in addition to sacrifices for the sins of the people and that kind of thing, there's also the sacrifices that came along with the consecrating of the priest. And the holy place when they set it up. So you know, that's the nature of the blood sacrifices that he has a brief reference to. And there's a second one. The second one had to do with the red heifer. It was a red heifer. Anybody remember what that was? I didn't give you the reading. I fell down, didn't I? Numbers 19. You read that? That's right. No, you don't have to go there. You didn't read it. I'll tell you. Numbers 19, sacrificed the red heifer and burned it and mixed the ashes with water. The purpose of which would be when people would come in contact with dead bodies and were unclean. That was the water that was used to clean them. And that's the water mixed with the ashes of the red heifer. And so there's if you put yourself in the circumstances of a person under the old covenant, as he describes it here in verse 13, they had been defiled in the heifer sprinkling. Those who have been defiled sanctified for the cleansing of the flesh. And then he'll go on and talk about how much more Christ. What was the purpose of all this cleansing and sacrificing and that kind of a thing? If you're it's not one of these questions by a lot of answers, I'm afraid. If you're a Jew in the
sin.
Well,
set apart.
Right. Clean.
Thank you. Who do you who do you have a covenant relationship with? The nation of Israel has a covenant relationship with God. And it is a viewed from the physical standpoint. You think about all the sacrifices, you think about all of the various laws about cleanliness. Is this because the body was dirty? No, ceremonial cleanliness. And it's to maintain that relationship, that covenant relationship that existed between God and the nation of Israel. And there's a different covenant relationship now that exists between us and that God, in that it is a covenant relationship, a spiritual covenant relationship. It has its focus on spiritual things. And he'll point that out. He points it out in 14. He points it out in really more as you go on in the chapter and in the book. We have that the access to God, if you please, under the old covenant was how? Sorry?
Access to God was through the priest.
Through the priest. I mean, you couldn't, you know, that you couldn't go in and, I mean, you couldn't go into the Holy of Holies. You couldn't even go into the tabernacle if you were, you know, common man. It was all between priest and you, priest, God. And remember what chapter, when we get chapter 10, was his. What's that, one of those phrases that we've talked about in the past that show up in the last part of in the middle of chapter 10? The product of what Christ has done? Two words.
Let us.
We have access. We can boldly approach. So we have a different relationship with God than the people of Israel did. Okay?
But he sets apart for himself a holy people today also.
Sure.
And he cleanses them through the blood of Christ.
Sure.
So it's, you know, it's really no different in the mind of Christ if he wants a holy nation that, you know, and to be cleansed, you know, you must be in order to be God's people.
Yeah, the product of the result of that, there's a different picture, if you like, what went on under the old law. And reasons for all of these things that came about. And that whole system was a shadow for what would come later. It was not the actual, it was a type or a shadow of what was to come.
It was also a reminder of the sin, the sacrifices.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. And there are three things, we'll be covering this more as we go through, but there are three, I call noteworthy things about Jesus' sacrifice that's mentioned in this section. One, that he offered himself, you know that. Two, that he offered willingly himself. And then, of course, third is that it was an unblemished sacrifice. Such is the nature of the sacrifice of Christ himself, God himself. 9:15, he says, for this reason, okay, and just again, looking back, for this reason he is a mediator of the new covenant, so that since death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of eternal inheritance. Listen careful. Maybe this will help you. I find this language always difficult to follow. The RSV, I think, captures the meaning better. It says, therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred which redeems them from the transgressions under the first covenant. This 9:15 is looking at Christ, efficacy of the blood of Christ. It's able to reach back to those under the old covenant and redeem them. Okay.
Is it also an explanation on that part of verse 14? It says, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. Is the dead works he's referring to here the dead works from the law, or is it the dead works that the Christian is sin in the past?
It's dead works of sin, I believe, in this. Not the law. That's not the works of any of okay, anything about that? Let's see if we can get through 16 and 17, 18. Verse 16, for where covenant is, and he just talked about committed under the first covenant, right? And he goes on and says, for where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. For a covenant is valid only when men are dead. But it is never enforced while the one who made it lives. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and of the goats and the water and the scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you. And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of ministry with the blood. And according to the law, one may almost say all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. I purposely wrote a bunch of junk in this lesson to help you, and maybe you don't need any help, to get through 16, 17, and 18, because what the translators did makes it very confusing, in my opinion. In fact, every translation, with the exception of the one I'm going to read you, and the New American Standard, will translate what we just read as covenant in 16 and 17 as testament or will. When you think about a testament or a will, particularly a will, what do you think of?
Somebody dies,
and they leave something to you, right? And that makes absolutely no sense in this context. And I'm not going to. I can get into the weeds if you like, but I don't think it serves a very good purpose as to, you know, the Greek and the line of logic says coming out and calling this testament. Looking at it as a testament makes no sense. I think it ought to be pretty obvious to us. From everybody here, I think, has New American Standard, right? Oh, we have. Okay, and it says. What does it say? Testament, doesn't it? Yeah. But look for a moment let's take the New American Standard for a minute. For where a covenant is, there must of necessity be the death of the one who made it. Who made the covenant to Noah?
God.
When he died. Who made the covenant to Abraham?
God.
And you just carry this to Advent infinitum. So obviously there's something amiss here. We just thoroughly don't understand it. Let me read to you. Let me tell you one thing. I'll just make this statement. You have to take it on faith. The Greek here has absolutely nothing about when you go through it about relating these deaths to men. Okay, the word's not there. Men's not there. Listen, for Young's literal, I think, captures what the Greek says. For where a covenant is, the death of the covenant victim to come in is necessary. In other words, it has to happen. For a covenant over dead victims is steadfast, since it is no force at all when the covenant victim liveth. Whence not even the first part, that is, the first covenant, apart from the blood, hath been initiated. In other words, you don't, to a Jew, if there was a covenant, what went along with that covenant in under the old law, the lion's share of cases, even before the old law? What was associated with the covenant God made?
The sacrifice of an animal.
Sacrifice. Blood. Right? And that's really what's being talked about here. The Greek won't support what the translators have put. They have interpreted. Why do you think they might have interpreted it as will or testament? it's speculation. Look at verse, look at the last part of verse 15. The promise of an eternal what?
Inheritance.
Inheritance. All right, let me ask a question without going through and looking at the verses. We'll go to several of them. But let's just talk about one person. Talk about Abraham. Covenant with Abraham, sacrifice involved. Was there a inheritance associated with the covenant with Abraham?
Yeah.
I hope so. Okay. To a Jew, inheritance associated with the covenant was nothing strange. What would be strange to the Jew is the idea that a covenant, or in other words, be the idea of a will, within a testament, a will. That's unheard of. Okay? So I want to get you past that. I just want you to see what's really being viewed here. When you look back in this whole, look on this section of both sides, we're dealing with the covenant. Under the old law, there had to be blood sacrifice. That's what he says in 19, correct? That's an illustration of 16 and 17. You can't have a covenant without the death of a victim. Okay? And normally that victim under, well, always a victim under the old law was what?
Animals.
And of course, under the new law, which is where he's carrying, which is why he brought this up, is it's a different blood. It is the blood of Christ. In fact, that's where he goes with verse 23 and beyond. Okay? Y'all okay with that? Y'all understand? And didn't lose you? Didn't leave you? And y'all going to say if I did? Alright. Yeah, I'd like to do 23 through 28, but I don't quite have enough time.
What about the questions?
Sorry?
The questions. Can you go through the questions?
Which ones do you want to go through?
About to make covenant, remember the covenant by.
I'm sorry, where are we?
That's right after your discussion on Hebrews 9, 16, 17.
Okay, one, what must take place before a covenant could be valid? That's what we're looking at?
Yeah, right after that. Since we made the covenant and the promise of God.
Back in the, who made the covenant? I'm sorry, who made the covenant? Who's the testator? Is that the question?
Yeah. Well,
who is that?
Where are we?
It's under the, it's in the paragraph, it's written out. Huh? Yeah, it's under the,
those questions.
That paragraph of stuff I gave you.
Oh, okay.
Who made the covenant?
God.
Yeah, God. God's the testator, isn't he? Testator being one who made it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did the one making the old covenant die? We talked about that, did he?
No.
Did the one making the new covenant die?
No.
Mm-hmm. No. If Christ the testator now alive, if one wanted to call Christ the testator, the one who made the covenant, well, he's now alive. Does that make the will of no effect? If that's what they were looking at, is a will? Because you know it says he must die. The one who makes it must die. Who died? Well, we know Christ died. So they're going to try to make it. Christ gave the covenant of the testament. You know, it's Christ's will. You know, last will of the testament. And then he dies and it comes into force. That just doesn't work at all.
So Christ's role was he was the sacrifice.
He's a mediator and a sacrifice. Sacrificial lamb.
Okay.
Okay.
That's what I think, the sacrifice. Okay.
Does that help? All right, we will pick up with verse 7, starting verse 23.